you're staring into the fridge and it's like 11 p.m.
Oh yeah, classic.
Right, you aren't actually hungry.
Right.
And you know you probably shouldn't be eating right now, but your hand is reaching for the shelf anyway, almost like your brain has been hacked by a ghost or something.
Completely.
Or, I don't know, maybe you're staring at an infuriating email, typing out this fiery response. And even though a tiny voice in your head is screaming that this is a terrible idea, you hit send anyway.
And instantly regret it.
Exactly. Have you ever felt, completely hijacked by a familiar habit or a sudden craving where you literally lose the ability to imagine any other option in that exact moment?
I mean, it's a universally frustrating experience. You are watching yourself act, but the choice feels like it was, I don't know, made for you 10 seconds ago.
Yeah.
You're awake, but you're just being carried away by a current.
That feeling of being a passenger in your own mind is exactly what we're tackling today. Because our mission for this deep dive is to unpack the actual mechanics of how we can regain control, how we can actively steer the mind when that internal pressure hits.
Right.
We're doing a deep dive into the RAFT program. Specifically, we're looking at Chapter 58, which is entirely focused on this concept called skillful intention.
And just to give you a bit of a roadmap before we jump into the deep end here, RAFT is an acronym.
Right, we should clarify that.
Yeah, it stands for Recognize, Abandon, Feeling, Train. Now, we're not going to dissect the entire four-part framework today.
No, we'd be here for hours.
Exactly. Instead, we're zooming right in on that final stage, the train stage. This chapter is all about moving from simply understanding your situation to actually doing something about it.
So, like knowing intellectually that you have a tendency to get caught in a sticky loop of anxiety or some destructive habit.
Yes. It's moving from that intellectual knowing to actively rehearsing how to navigate your way out of it when the pressure is actually on.
So it's about bridging that gap between insight and action. Because, I mean, I can sit here all day and analyze why I reach for my phone every time I'm stressed.
We all do it.
Right. But when the stress actually hits, that analysis just totally evaporates. So how do we move from just staring at the problem to actually interrupting the compulsion?
Well, the RAFT program uses a really brilliant nautical metaphor to explain this transition. To train the mind, we have to differentiate between knowing our location and actually choosing a direction of travel.
Okay, I got that.
In the framework, they talk about skillful perspective. Perspective is like reading the map or the nautical chart. It's seeing the weather patterns, recognizing the currents, knowing what's driving the rough waters.
Yeah.
But skillful intention, which is our focus today, is the rudder.
Okay, let's unpack this boat analogy a bit more.
Yeah.
So skillful perspective is me looking at the horizon and realizing, okay, a massive storm of resentment is rolling in because my boss just criticized me.
Spot on, you see it.
I see it. But skillful intention is me actually stepping up, grabbing the wheel, and locking in a deliberate direction so my boat doesn't just capsize or, smash into the rocks.
That is the core dynamic right there. Intention sets the course. But, and this is really important, we have to be careful with how we define the word intention here because it gets misunderstood a lot.
How so?
Well, intention isn't just a passing mood. A mood just arrives based on external conditions. And it isn't an impulse, which is just this blind pull.
Right, an impulse is what gets us into trouble in the first place.
Exactly. And it's definitely not some vague mystical wish. Intention, as defined in this chapter, is a deliberate, rehearsed choice. It's a quiet, steady lean that we practice over and over again.
The steady lean.
Yeah, until it actually becomes the mind's default way of operating.
The idea of a steady lean implies something continuous.
Yeah.
Like it's not a massive, heroic, one-time exertion of willpower, which, let's be honest, usually fails anyway.
Oh, almost always.
Yeah, it's a subtle, constant adjustment of the course. But, I mean, how does just leaning our thoughts in a certain direction actually change our behavior long term?
It really comes down to what we are feeding our mind. There's a foundational quote from the text that grounds this perfectly. It's from Gautama, the Buddha. And he observed, "Whatever a person frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of the mind."
Wait, if we really unpack that, that means if I keep replaying a grievance in my head or obsessing over a particular craving, I'm not just ruining my afternoon.
No, you're doing much more than that.
I am actively carving out the path that my mind will naturally want to take the next time I'm triggered. Like, I am literally rehearsing my own drift.
You are building the neural superhighway for that exact compulsion. What we frequently rehearse becomes easier to live. So if intention is our rudder, the next logical step is to figure out the coordinates.
Right.
When the weather turns bad and the pull of a familiar habit kicks in, where exactly are we trying to steer?
Because if I'm caught in the middle of a powerful urge, I can't just tell my brain, hey, don't do that. I need an active alternative. I need an actual destination to steer towards.
Exactly. You can't steer toward nowhere. So the RAFT program lays out three distinct rudder settings. These aren't passive states you just hope will magically appear. They are active, deliberate directions you rehearse.
Okay, what are they?
The first setting is abandoning. The second is goodwill. And the third is harmlessness.
Okay, let's stop on that first one because it sounds a bit problematic. Abandoning.
I know, it can sound intense.
To a modern ear, abandoning just sounds like grim self-denial. It evokes this image of white-knuckling through life, constantly depriving yourself and forcing a miserable no to everything you want.
Yeah.
If the goal is freedom, how does shrinking our lives help?
It is entirely understandable to read it that way at first glance, but the text clarifies that it is the exact opposite. Abandoning isn't about shrinking your life. It is about unburdening it.
Unburdening?
Yes. It is the practice of letting go, simplifying, and releasing the heavy things that feed our cravings. It directly counters that restless, exhausting, deeply ingrained belief that just a little more stimulation or one more purchase or one more drink will finally make us feel complete.
Oh, I see. So it's less about locking yourself in a monastic cell and more about, like, dropping a heavy backpack you didn't even realize you were carrying.
That's a great way to put it.
It's a no to the compulsion, which actually opens up space for a yes to a life that is lighter.
Going back to our boat metaphor, abandoning is choosing to steer away from those trap islands. They look like comfortable places to drop anchor and hide from the storm, but they're surrounded by shallow reefs that will keep your vessel stuck.
Ah, right.
Abandoning is steering back out into open water where you can actually maneuver.
That reframing changes the entire concept. It goes from being this rigid restriction to a genuine release.
Okay, so what about the second setting? Goodwill. So goodwill is the deliberate practice of friendliness toward yourself and others. It is the direct antidote to resentment, irritation, and the self-hatred that often accompanies a sticky loop.
Because when we are caught in a bad habit or a conflict, the internal temperature just skyrockets, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. We want to blame someone, or we punish ourselves, or we just try to forcefully push reality away. Practicing goodwill cools the heat of that reactivity.
It lowers the temperature on deck.
Yes, allowing you to keep your hands steady on the helm instead of lashing out and damaging your own ship.
That makes perfect sense. And then the third setting is harmlessness. How does that differ from goodwill? They sound kind of similar.
They are related, but harmlessness is the practice of compassion and non-cruelty. While goodwill is about friendliness, harmlessness asks one very specific protective question. Does this choice reduce harm for me and for those around me? This setting directly counters the numbness, the aggression, or the careless collateral damage we often inflict when we are lost in a compulsion. It keeps us from crashing our vessel into other boats or, you know, polluting the waters we all share.
So we have abandoning to counter the exhausting pull of craving, goodwill to cool down the heat of resentment, and harmlessness to shake us out of our numb, aggressive autopilot.
That's the trio.
But, I mean, this brings us to a massive hurdle. Knowing these three settings intellectually is great. But why does simply setting an intention actually work against habits that have been deeply ingrained over years or even decades?
Right, because the pull of these loops is incredibly strong.
Exactly. So why does this work?
That is the million-dollar question. And it takes us into the science and philosophy of steering. The text introduces a profound concept from the teacher Stephen Batchelor, who refers to intention as a form of imagination.
Imagination.
But he doesn't mean idle daydreaming or fantasy. He defines it as ethically guided creativity.
Ethically guided creativity. Let's linger on that for a second. What does a compulsion have to do with creativity?
Think about the internal experience of being caught in a powerful habit loop. You suffer from what Batchelor calls a poverty of imagination.
Right.
In that moment of intense craving or intense rage, your mind literally cannot picture any option other than executing the habit. The habit feels utterly inevitable. Your brain's creative capacity to visualize a different future shrinks down to practically zero.
Wow.
So setting a skillful intention restores your ability to choose by forcing your mind to creatively picture a wiser response before you're completely engulfed.
That is a staggering way to look at it.
Yeah.
So when I'm, say, doom scrolling at midnight, it's not just a lack of discipline. It's a temporary failure of my brain's creative engine.
Exactly.
My mind simply cannot fathom the concept of putting the phone down and turning off the lamp. It has lost the ability to imagine a different outcome.
Yes, and neuroscience maps this out beautifully. When we look under the hood, compulsions and sticky loops run on fast-acting, highly efficient circuitry in the basal ganglia.
The basal ganglia.
Right. This is ancient, survival-based machinery that operates on autopilot to save energy. But setting a conscious intention recruits the brain's executive networks, specifically the prefrontal cortex.
And that's the part responsible for complex planning, right?
Mm-hmm.
Projecting into the future, evaluating long-term outcomes.
Yes. But the prefrontal cortex is famously slow and energy-hungry, which is why the basal ganglia usually wins in a sudden moment of stress.
Precisely the problem. The fast habit system hijacks the wheel before the slower choice system even realizes there's a storm.
But when we deliberately pause and set a direction ahead of time, we are booting up that executive network early. We are giving the prefrontal cortex a head start.
Oh, I love that. So it is quite literally like a basketball player visualizing a free throw before actually shooting the ball.
That is exactly what it's like.
You are forcing the slow, deliberate part of your brain to run a simulation. So when the physical action happens, it isn't completely hijacked by your fast, twitchy reflexes.
That analogy is spot on. And behavioral psychology leverages this exact mechanism through something called if-then implementation plans.
If-then plans. Like coding for your brain.
Pretty much. You decide well in advance. If the urge to snap at my partner hits at 6 p.m. when I'm tired, then I will walk into the other room for 2 minutes. By building this bridge ahead of time, you drastically reduce your cognitive load under stress.
Because you don't have to improvise a healthy response while you're standing in the middle of a Category 5 hurricane.
Exactly. You have already pre-linked the trigger to a skillful, rehearsed action.
You set the rudder while the water is calm, so it's already locked when the weather turns.
Beautifully said.
But I imagine this only works if the direction you're steering actually means something to you. I mean, I can't just visualize a free throw if I hate basketball.
That connects directly to how the RAFT program incorporates acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT, as well as virtue ethics. This kind of mental rehearsal fails if it's just a clinical exercise in, you know, avoiding a mistake.
Right. It has to have some weight to it.
It has to be anchored in your core values. According to virtue ethics, you are practicing these dispositions, abandoning, goodwill, harmlessness, to actually cultivate your character. You are practicing becoming the person you genuinely want to be.
So the intention has to have emotional credibility to you.
Absolutely. You have to want the freedom of the open water more than you want the false comfort of the trap island.
That makes the stakes so much clearer. It's about identity, not just behavioral tricks. So now that we have the philosophy and the neuroscience, let's talk execution.
Let's do it.
I'm in the moment. The familiar drift starts pulling at me. My basal ganglia is screaming at me to do the habit. How do I actually pivot?
The RAFT program provides a highly practical 7-step sequence for exactly these moments.
Mm.
But rather than just listing them off like a manual, let's look at how they flow together. We can group them into 3 phases. The pause, the pivot, and the action.
Okay, the pause, the pivot, and the action. Got it.
The first phase, the pause, starts with step 1. Name the pull. You call it out gently but directly in your mind, like grasping is here or resentment is pulling.
Which instantly gives you distance. It stops being this foggy, overwhelming atmosphere and becomes an object you can actually observe.
Yes.
What is the second part of the pause?
Step 2 is call the tone and soften the body. You quickly notice the underlying feeling. Is it pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? And then, crucially, you deliberately take 3 soft out-breaths to relax physical tension.
I want to push on that for a second.
Mm.
Why is relaxing the physical body a necessary step for changing a mental loop? I mean, if the problem's in my thoughts, why do I care about my shoulders being tight?
Because your brain and your body are in a constant, rapid feedback loop. When a compulsion hits, the body braces. It clenches.
Oh, right. The fight or flight response.
Exactly. Your amygdala reads that physical tension as confirmation that a severe threat is present, which keeps your brain locked in a rigid survival mode tunnel vision. By deliberately softening the body and debracing your muscles, you are sending a physiological signal back up to the brain that the emergency is over. Suddenly, the prefrontal cortex has the breathing room it needs to actually choose an option.
That is fascinating.
Hmm.
The physical relaxation literally turns down the alarm bells in the brain.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've paused, we've named the pull, we've softened the body. Now we enter the second phase, the pivot. How do we shift gears?
This brings us to step three. Choose the intention that fits. You don't argue with the urge. You just select one of your three rudder coordinates.
So abandoning goodwill or harmlessness.
Right. Do you need to abandon and simplify? Do you need goodwill to soften a harsh judgment? Or do you need harmlessness to protect yourself from acting destructively? You quietly pick the coordinate.
And then?
Then step four is set a cue. You give yourself a short, memorable phrase to anchor that choice. Something simple like let go or stay kind or do no harm.
A micro mantra that the mind can hold on to even when the cognitive load is heavy.
Exactly. And then comes step five, which connects back to Batchelor's poverty of imagination.
Oh, the ethically guided creativity part.
Yes. Step five is preview it. Before you make any physical move, you rehearse the wiser option in your mind's eye for just a split second. You visualize yourself closing the laptop or walking out of the room or taking a sip of water instead of yelling.
Because the mind has a strong neurological tendency to follow the action it has most vividly pictured.
You're painting the new reality so the brain knows exactly where to step.
Which leads to the final phase, the action.
Step six is take one small step. You choose a single, doable action that embodies your intention right now. Delete the draft message, step outside for fresh air, delay your reaction by 10 minutes.
It doesn't have to resolve the entire crisis.
Not at all. One tiny step is enough to break the hypnotic spell of the habit. And finally, step seven is close the loop. You take a brief moment to register what just happened. You tell yourself, I noticed the pull. I chose a direction. I steered.
Why is that final acknowledgement so important? It feels like you could just skip that once you've successfully stepped away.
Because closing the loop is how the nervous system learns. It logs the data point that you can experience the intense pull of a compulsion without obeying it. That quiet internal recognition is the raw material that builds true long-term confidence.
Name the pull. Soften the body, choose the intention, set a cue, preview the action, take a small step, and close the loop. It is a highly engineered protocol to bypass our worst instincts.
It really is.
But let's be real for a second here. We aren't robots.
Yeah.
What if I tried the steps, I soften my body, I pick my intention, but the rudder just slips?
It happens.
Right? What if an unhelpful thought is completely stuck on repeat, and no matter how much I breathe, the loop just won't stop playing?
It is vital to normalize this. Drifting happens. The practice is about the return, not about achieving flawless perfection. The RAFT program emphasizes that we cannot turn a momentary drift into a final, crushing verdict on our character.
That's a relief.
However, when you do encounter those incredibly stubborn, sticky loops, the text offers five targeted unsticking options. You don't run through all of them like a checklist. You evaluate the situation and deploy the one that fits best.
Okay, so how do we figure out which tool to use? Walk us through the mechanics of these options.
The first option is replace it with the opposite. If you have a thought that is aggressively critical, you deliberately manufacture a thought that is kind or realistic to crowd it out.
So you're basically overriding it.
You are essentially starving the unhelpful thought of its real estate in your working memory. But if the loop is too strong for that, you move to the second option. Reflect on the downside.
Is that like playing the tape forward to see the consequences?
Exactly. You vividly imagine where this sticky thought will lead you if you indulge it. You visualize the hangover, the regret, the broken relationship, or the sheer exhaustion that will inevitably follow. You make the trap visible so it loses its appeal.
But what if the thought is just completely irrational and obsessive, like a song stuck in your head, but darker?
Then you try the third option. Withdraw attention. Stop negotiating with it entirely. You consciously shift your focus to a neutral, physical anchor. You pay attention to the sensation of the soles of your feet on the floor or the ambient sounds in the room. You starve the loop of your attention.
Got it.
If that fails, the fourth option is soften the physical tension, which we discussed earlier. You scan your body for the clenched jaw, the tight belly, the raised shoulders, and you force them to relax, thereby cutting off the physiological fuel that is keeping the mental alarm ringing.
And if all else fails, if the storm is right on top of you and the loop just refuses to break,
then you use the fifth option. Contain it with firm resolve. Sometimes a gentle redirection just isn't enough. You have to set a hard internal boundary. You mentally say, not now, and firmly anchor your attention to what actually matters in that moment.
Like putting your foot down.
Exactly. And the text references an ancient and eternal law from Gautama here. Hatred is never appeased by hatred in this world. By non-hatred alone is hatred appeased. You cannot fight a violently agitated mind with more agitation.
Right. You cannot scream at your sticky loop to shut up.
You have to meet that internal chaos with unshakable, steady resolve and a refusal to feed the fire.
That is a profound operating principle. You can't put out a fire with gasoline.
Exactly.
So synthesizing everything we've unpacked today, from the nautical charts to the neuroscience, the core takeaway is that skillful intention isn't some monumental vow we carve into stone once and never struggle with again.
No, not at all.
It is a daily, living aspiration. It's the micro practice of setting your coordinates before you act, deliberately leaning your mind toward abandoning goodwill or harmlessness, and taking one small step at a time to build the person you want to be.
It is the lifelong training of the mind's default lean. Every single time you choose the rudder over the current, you are reshaping your future.
Incredible. Well, before we wrap up, we need to make sure you know exactly where this incredible framework comes from. The RAFT to Freedom workbook is written by Dr. Catherine Jacob and Vince Cullen. And in a truly remarkable act of generosity, they are making the entire 66-chapter program freely available online. You can read it, download the materials, and work through the entire framework yourself at raft2freedom.org. That is raft2freedom.org.
It is an unparalleled resource for anyone looking to understand the mechanics of their own mind. And to leave you with something to digest as you move through your day, I want to offer a final self-reflection taken straight from the end of the chapter.
Please do.
If you could rewind one moment from this past week, what intention would you choose the second time around?
Think about your map, think about your rudder, and think about the direction you actually want to travel. Because as the author John Anster wrote at the close of this chapter, what you can do or dream you can, begin it. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it.
The storm might be rolling in, but you do not have to be a passenger on autopilot.
But I'll leave you with this final, somewhat unsettling thought. As you go through your week and you realize that our daily intentions physically wire the future of our brains, ask yourself this. What default lean are the algorithms of the apps you use every single day trying to rehearse for you? Are you holding the rudder of your mind, or are they? Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.